Hey guys, welcome back to the forum where science comes to socialize. I'm Cleo, and as usual, I have Aubrey and Daniela here with me to break down some sort of permutation of a complex and awesome scientific debate for you all today.
But before we dive into that, remember to visit us on Twitter at ISGP Forum, and of course on Facebook as well by searching for ISGP's The Forum. Like true millennials, our social media game is on point.
I think you mean on Fleek.
Aren't people just saying V for very now?
Or is it P for pretty?
Okay, so we're millennials, but we need some work at
Okay, also be sure to scroll through our SoundCloud channel to check out any past episodes you may have missed. Not to brag, some of our recent ones are definitely on point or on fleek or whatever adjective synonymous with good you prefer.
Or to just listen again to your favorite episode, because there's obviously no reason why you would have ever missed an episode of the forum ever.
Right, obviously not. Okay, so what super awesome, interesting corner of the science world are we exploring today, guys?
Well, today I thought we could tackle some issues in the sphere of synthetic biology, and we can also relate how this discipline, often referred to as synbio, impacts vaccine production. The debate summary and paper we have on this subject is from 2011, which honestly feels like forever ago, but a lot of the information and issues that arise are still extremely relevant to right now, which explains why we want to talk about it today, since 6 years of time hasn't addressed all the challenges.
Wow, 2011. Guys, we were just graduating high school that year.
Oh God, so weird. Actually, I just had an official high school reunion, which was definitely pretty strange. Actually, being there reminded me that at that point, I thought I was out of my awkward stage, but looking back, I was realizing I was so mistaken.
I'm right there with you, D. We realistically will probably never leave that stage. Like, it's not even a stage now, it's just life. Like, this is just how we are.
Speak for yourselves, guys. I don't know.
Okay, I'm totally embracing it. I'm right there with you, Cleo.
Yeah, definitely.
But really, was that still flip phone era? That's a stage I'd like to never return to. Anyway, let's just save the rest of the reminiscing for later.
Okay, sounds good. So, the information we discuss today will be coming from the Institute on Science for Global Policy's conference called Emerging and Persistent Infectious Diseases: Focus on Mitigation, which took place in October 2011 in Edinburgh, Scotland. The paper we'll be talking about is titled Synthetic Biology: A New Weapon in Our War Against Infectious Diseases, and was written by Dr. John Glass, a professor at the J. Craig Venter Institute.
And don't forget that if today's podcast sparks your interest, you can find this very policy position paper and the summary of its debate at the ISGP's website, scienceforglobalpolicy.org, under the Publications tab.
So, in some of our past episodes on epidemiology, we've alluded to synthetic biology as a potential option and opportunity for advancement. So, today we're actually going to get a chance to dig a little deeper into that idea.
Excellent. So, synthetic biology. This is a super important debate topic because it's a rapidly growing field and has been helping us make significant improvements in infectious disease prevention and mitigation. Synthetic biology can sort of broadly be defined as the design and creation of new artificial biological things. These things can consist of anything from biological pathways or organisms to the redesigning of existing natural biological systems.
To understand the importance of this, though, let's first talk a little about how synthetic biology differs from traditional molecular biology and why this difference is even relevant in the first place.
Good idea. So, synthetic biology and traditional molecular biology actually vary quite significantly in terms of both scale and speed with which new material can be created. With the automated methods characteristic of synbio applications, it's so much easier, not to mention exponentially faster, to make multiple variants of genes.
To give you an example of this, synthesizing copies of influenza genes, which are then used in the creation of flu vaccines, used to take weeks. Now, with the help of synthetic biology, this process can be completed in mere hours. This leap in productivity has some arguing that synthetic biology should be considered a revolutionary technology, because in many ways it's a groundbreaking development that's qualitatively different from older technologies.
In molecular biology, which is considered kind of a classic or traditional method at this point, genetic engineering must start with a biological entity. Now, with synthetic biology, and I'm just going to use that shortened version, synbio, from this point on, because who has the time for extra syllables?
Millennial!
With synbio, it's possible to synthesize a genome and create an organism starting only with information on a computer database and the appropriate chemicals. So creating a virus like polio, which would normally be really difficult with molecular biology, suddenly becomes very feasible.
Some people argue, though, that synbio is really more evolutionary as opposed to revolutionary because it can still only create things that already exist. And the reason this little debate is important, and I get it, it sounds like a tomato-tomato thing, is because the classification of synbio has important implications for how it's actually regulated. But either way, the gist is that synbio is faster and synthesizes genes in a much larger quantity than molecular biology.
Wait, I feel like we really jumped right over this, but creating polio? Did I hear that right? Aren't there some major implications and risks associated with technology this powerful?
Definitely. And I was actually going to bring that up next. Both Dr. Glass and the debaters at this conference were sure not to ignore the concern for the potential harmful consequences that stem from either intentional or inadvertent misuse of synbio tools. With how accessible this information is, and with the rise of do-it-yourself biology, aka DIY bio, another millennial term, concerns over issues like bioterrorism or just simply unintentional misuse are certainly not overreactions.
Retrieving this information can be as simple as accessing databases like GenBank, an online database for all publicly available DNA sequences, downloading a series of oligonucleotide sequences, and then ordering DNA from a commercial DNA synthesis company. And Aubrey, if you wouldn't mind reminding our listeners what an oligonucleotide is, that would be great, because I don't feel qualified to do so, despite the number of times we've talked about genomes on this show.
My pleasure. And it's a simple thing. Recall that nucleotides are the units that make up a DNA molecule. They're the A's, T's, C's, and G's we harp on a bunch here on the forum. Oligonucleotides, then, are literally just short chains of these nucleotides. Oligo in Greek means few, so they usually contain somewhere between 13 and 25 nucleotides apiece.
See, I knew that, but you just put it so much more eloquently.
Aw, thanks. That's basically how I feel about you when it comes to behavioral and sociological issues surrounding food.
Back off, Aubrey. She's mine.
Oh, and the claws come out.
I feel so loved today, guys.
And don't forget it. Anyway, while accessing this DNA sequence data is relatively simple, there's still an extremely high level of expertise required to actually create a dangerous pathogen. It's super difficult to increase the pathogenicity of an organism just in general, let alone accidentally. So creating a pathogen by mistake is, at least up until this point, basically unheard of. Therefore, the highest rates of concern lie with intentional misuse of these technologies.
With the advent of new technologies like synbio, it's pretty much inevitable that there will be attempts to use them for nefarious purposes. And if the topic of preventing bioterrorism and stopping evildoers is of great interest to you, spoiler alert, that will be the main focus of our new episode coming in 2 weeks, so definitely check back for that. In any case, the debaters at this conference we're talking about today generally agree that the benefits outweigh the risks, and that the perception of synthetic biology being more dangerous than past genetic engineering projects using molecular biology simply does not reflect reality.
Regardless of the real versus perceived dangers, though, there's no doubt that increased access to a range of DNA sequence information can be seen as both an opportunity and a challenge. As far as opportunities go, as gene synthesis becomes cheaper and much faster, synthetic biology will continue to become accessible to scientists in increasingly diverse disciplines. And this is really cool because suddenly we have the potential for a significant positive impact across not only the field of infectious disease, but also across a variety of scientific disciplines and industries. But before we go any further, I just have to butt in and say that although this debate came to the conclusion that you can now get your genes mapped for about 7 cents per nucleotide base, which is very low. The lowest I could get quoted on Google said 11 cents. So the verdict is still out on this. And if you have any info on these pricing matters, then definitely let us know. Anyways, back to accessibility of this technology.
Right. Okay. So we can't forget that with this greater accessibility comes an increase in likelihood that an individual with harmful intentions will be able to capitalize on synthetic biology. So a major challenge becomes limiting the potential for these adverse events.
It's theoretically possible to order DNA online and then synthesize genes within a few weeks using machines that can be also purchased online. Thus, the potential exists for scientists to create pathogens outside of a supervised laboratory.
And outside of this supervision, we really have no way of controlling or totally ruling out the chance of someone creating a harmful pathogen.
Okay, so I get that we can't control people's actions with this type of powerful technology, but don't we have some sort of way to create a monitoring system that would enable the tracing of engineered or synthetic organisms in the event of an accidental or intentional release?
Well, yes, sort of. It's currently possible for researchers to quote-unquote sign their work so that it can be traced back to its original owner, but figuring out how to persuade synthetic biologists to always use these tags or tracers, especially if they have malicious intent, definitely remains an unresolved issue.
Yeah, I could see how getting a criminal to sign their name on their work might be a little bit difficult. It'd be kind of like counterfeiters putting their own little stamp on the fake money they make. I mean, I've heard of being proud of your work, but...
Yeah, that wouldn't happen. But another way to potentially contain engineered organisms is to alter the genetic code to require a synthetic amino acid for protein synthesis. In this sense, we would theoretically render it unable to survive outside of the controlled laboratory conditions.
Got it. So without a lab, they die and can't go on existing freely in the natural world. I feel like we might have talked about that in a past episode. I think we compared it to a big red self-destruct button.
I mean, probably. We do have over 2 years worth of episodes floating out in cyberspace by now.
First with the high school graduation year, now with the forum's age. We're really hammering home the whole we're old thing today, aren't we? But the issue with this, once again, is that we can't actually guarantee that building in that red button will actually happen. Again, why would a criminal intending to release a pathogen make it self-destructive in nature? And then again, even if an organism is designed to create positive outcomes, it is impossible to know whether or not the organism would create unintentional harm through unpredictable genetic changes once left to its own devices in the environment.
Jeez, I feel like Cleo's normally the negative one on the show.
Hey.
Not you, Aubrey.
I guess it must be the feeling old thing. What can I say?
And because of these reasons, among many, the development of effective safety mechanisms is so important and could minimize the risk of adverse outcomes, even if these risks can't be completely eliminated, which is okay because any new technology has risks associated with it. We use them anyway if the risks are outweighed by benefits. Just, you know, as a reminder.
As usual, with these types of things, there's a ton of disparity in opinions worldwide. For example, while agencies in some less affluent countries are reluctant to accept synthetically made vaccines, others, such as United States National Institutes of Health, NIH, and Food and Drug Administration, FDA, are increasingly amenable to using such vaccines.
But even within more developed westernized countries, there are still ongoing disputes. While some countries in Europe currently market influenza vaccines that have been synthetically created in mammalian cells, this is not universally accepted throughout the continent. Likewise, the FDA may be increasingly amenable to these synthetic vaccines, but there are still quite a few regulatory hurdles. Also worth noting here is the idea that the process for synthetic vaccine approval could be sped up significantly, but likely will only happen if there's political will to do so.
Control of synthetic biology research is also considered to be inconsistent throughout the world. So while the US and Europe are moving towards stricter regulations, other parts of the world currently have limited or even no guidelines or regulatory frameworks for the use of synthetic biology. Because of the potential risk of bioterrorism and pathogen misuse that SynBio presents, the debaters repeatedly noted throughout this debate that there's an urgent need for an international regulatory framework to oversee this technology.
It was also noted that while prominent bodies are recognizing the need for regulation, many governments have been slow to act on these issues. However, one specific area of regulation where governments can begin is screening. The debaters thought that a screening system is needed that blocks people from ordering DNA agents that could be used to make potentially dangerous viruses or organisms. Again, more on this is coming in 2 weeks' time, right here on the forum.
I like what you did there. And let's not forget that we can also sort of treat synthetic biology like GMOs, in terms of regulation anyway. Regulation already in place to handle GMOs could also, in theory, be applied to SynBio.
But if you're a form regular, then you know we have repeatedly mentioned in previous episodes how the use, creation, and innovation of genetic modification is often stifled by heavy regulations, particularly in Europe. Stringent European regulations have had crippling effects on the use of GMOs in many parts of Europe, and it's likely thought to have the same future effect on SynBio if applied. So when it comes to translating GMO regulations to synthetic biology, treading lightly may be well advised.
Implementing brand new regulations, though, could excessively heighten perceptions of the dangers associated with SynBio, which may impede public acceptance of such technologies.
There's also this fear in regards to regulation that if more affluent countries increasingly regulate emerging technologies while the rest of the world does not, the development and advancement of science and technology in wealthier countries may actually lag behind other regions.
In an attempt to remedy these issues, it was proposed that the implementation of a gentle structure might sufficiently negate the need for an actual governing or regulatory body. The components of such a structure weren't really defined, but it was contended that regulation be one part of a multifaceted approach that also includes an informal code of conduct for scientists.
Another way we can also look at this puzzle is to see the regulation of SynBio as we see the regulation of things like nuclear activities or computer viruses.
Nuclear activities and computer viruses. Totally just like synthetic biology.
Why do I sense some sarcasm here, Cleo?
Yeah, I definitely don't see how these things are related.
Okay, it's a little bit of a stretch. But regulation in these areas has often reflected cooperation between the private and public sectors and has demonstrated positive exchanges of information and intelligence across different agencies. Therefore, the same types of frameworks could be used for monitoring SynBio.
Ultimately, though, this, as usual, comes down to an issue of education. Educating current and future scientists is a potentially constructive way to prevent intentional or unintentional harm from occurring through synthetic biology activities.
It was suggested that a substantial part of graduate education for those who work in synthetic biology-related fields include understanding their responsibilities, the risks involved, and their obligations to the field and to society. Some universities are actually a little ahead of the game here and are already incorporating this type of education into their curricula.
Education of the public is important too, though, as the global dissemination of synthetic biology-related technologies requires the public to be educated about the risks and benefits of the field.
But again, scientists and communicators must be extra careful not to overemphasize the risks. As we have seen with GMOs, negative perceptions and misunderstandings of risk may be difficult to correct once already in place, and scientific advancement is often suppressed when such views are not countered. So, we should be using the GMO scenario as a learning opportunity and not make the same mistakes twice.
Alrighty, well, I think that's sufficient for our discussion today. Synthetic biology can do awesome things for infectious disease prevention. There are some significant risks regarding purposeful misuse and abuse of the technology, and it's important that we all educate ourselves on the issue so as to not stifle its innovation and future successes.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Also, don't forget to connect with us on social media if you have any questions or comments about today's show. What do you think about these regulatory suggestions? Is synthetic biology more of an opportunity or a challenge? Do the benefits outweigh the risks?
Let us know on Twitter at ISGP Forum or on Facebook by searching for ISGP's The Forum. And be sure to come back here in 2 weeks for a continuation of this very discussion when we'll delve further into the topic of preventing misuse of synthetic biology and other life science technologies.
Thanks so much for socializing with science today. We'll catch you next time right here on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.